This is just the type of situation we were hoping to avoid with the emergency petition.
A wolf dies in a trapper's snare on the edge of Denali National Park. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a teenager in residential treatment tells her story.
It took me 3 months to realize that, like, I was important and that, like, they let me hurt myself, like, I didn't deserve it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
And by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
It is day 92 of the legislative session, and lawmakers still have not reached a compromise on the state's budget. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez joins us from a very quiet capital. Hi, Alexandra.
Hello, Lori.
So what happened today?
It would be wrong to say nothing, but it feels like it. You know, it's bad when even lawmakers are taking to Twitter to vent about having to hurry up and wait. Since the legislature failed to gavel out on Sunday, no standing committees have met and no bills have been put to a vote. All activity is concentrated around a few key negotiators, with everyone else mostly sitting around as a deal hopefully gets brokered.
Well, Alexandra, what is the holdup exactly?
There are a few major sticking points with the budget right now. Because the state is facing a $4 billion deficit, the legislature and the governor have been in cutting mode, but there's disagreement on what to cut and how deep to go. The biggest disagreement has been over education. At the very last stage in the committee process, the Senate Finance Committee cut nearly $50 million in classroom funding. They originally said it was for leverage, but now they're sticking to those cuts. They even called a press conference to defend their position, which the House and the governor have both argued just went too far. The Senate Finance Committee said that because the state is in such a fiscal crisis, even education needs to feel some of the cuts. It's also worth noting that as of 4 p.m., this press conference was the only organized event to happen in the Capitol today. It's also worth noting that at no point did the senators at the presser say they were on the verge of a budget deal.
So kind of set the scene for us. Walk us through the dynamics between the negotiating parties.
This has been a somewhat unusual year in that House Democrats are even involved at all. Because the state is facing such a major revenue shortfall, the legislature realistically needs to withdraw money from the state's constitutional budget reserve. That's the state's rainy day fund, which requires a three-quarter vote to tap. The Republican majority can't get that vote without bringing some House Democrats along, so they actually have some leverage. This means you have the Republican Senate majority, who is committed to their cuts to the operating budget, the Democratic House minority, who want to see Medicaid expansion and increased school funding as part of a budget deal, and then the House majority, who is somewhere in between.
So how long is this going to take?
It's anybody's guess, and there is a friendly betting pool for bragging rights going on in the Capitol. Lawmakers and staff are having to continually reschedule their plane and ferry tickets. And the strongest statement I've heard is from House Minority Leader Chris Tuck, who said the soonest the legislature could gavel out is tomorrow night. But then again, he gave me the same answer yesterday, and he could very well give me the same answer tomorrow.
All right. Well, thank you for giving us that update, Alexandra.
Thank you, Lori.
That was APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reporting from Juneau. Alaska State Trooper investigators say the father of the man suspected of shooting two officers removed the slain officers' handguns from their holsters and cocked them to make it appear as if his son had acted to save his life. The Fairbanks Daily News Miner reports investigators testified Monday in the Nenana trial of Arvin Kangas, who is charged with evidence tampering. His son, Nathaniel Kangas, faces murder charges in the deaths of Sergeant Scott Johnson and Trooper Gabe Rich. They were shot May 1st in Tanana as they attempted to arrest Arvin Kangas. Trooper Raymond Dunford testified that audio recorders worn by the fallen troopers picked up the sound of Johnson's handgun being cocked. He says he also heard what sounded like the pistol being placed under Johnson's body. There's a renewed push for greater protection of declining Denali National Park wolves. The effort follows news that a park wolf was discovered dead last month from a snare injury. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The dead wolf was recovered south of the road into Denali National Park in the Sanctuary River area March 12th during an annual spring wolf survey. National Park Service spokeswoman Chris Pfister says the park radio-collared wolf had a cabled snare around its neck.
The snare was caught on the radio collar, which may have been why it didn't immediately suffocate. And instead, it was somehow able to break the snare free. And we're not sure how long it lived before it succumbed either to starvation, or in this case, it looked like it probably actually bled to death.
Pfister says the one-year-old male wolf was likely snared on state land outside the park. The incident follows two similar ones in 2008. Alaska Trappers Association President Randy Zarnke says snares are typically secured to trees, and it's very rare for an animal to get away.
Doesn't happen hardly ever. I assume that what happened is a wolf chewed through the snare cable.
The trapping of Denali wolves outside the park's northeastern boundary inspired the Alaska Board of Game to create a protective buffer zone there in 1992. It was rescinded, modified, brought back, and then eliminated in 2010 when the board also issued a six-year moratorium on dealing with the contentious issue. The spring count of Denali wolves puts the population at 52, a 20-year low. But the park's Pfister cites trapping as just one factor in a wolf decline, thought to be more driven by access to moose and caribou.
This summer, we actually had an adult female wolf that had starved to death, and the mate also abandoned her territory and subsequently drowned when crossing a large river, and that's a possibility that he may also have been weakened by starvation.
Two of seven collared park wolf fatalities in the past year were human-caused. The Board of Game turned down an emergency petition seeking reinstatement of a buffer zone at a March 15th meeting, during which there was no mention of the snaring incident. Pfister says the agency was not at the meeting and decided to withhold the information.
Because it would potentially point fingers at what is legal activity outside of the park, and it would only serve those who wish that activity to cease.
News of the snared park wolf recently leaked to buffer advocates like Nancy Bale with the Denali Citizens Council.
Type of situation we were hoping to avoid with the emergency petition.
The DCC's bail points to human harvest as something that can be controlled to affect Denali wolf numbers.
DCC never stated that the only reason wolves die in Denali National Park is because of trapping and hunting, but right now with numbers so low, any hunting and trapping deaths that do occur should be prevented.
Buffer advocates are asking Fish and Game to close the wolf harvest in the proposed buffer area for the rest of the season. The snared wolf was part of the shrinking East Fork Pack, a group that often roams along the park road where visitors can spot the animals. A sharp decline in park wolf viewing opportunity is cited by buffer advocates. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a look at why the size of the Native Youth Olympics has tripled in the last quarter century.
They want to make sure that everybody is holding on to what they've learned from their elders.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
This week on APRN, we're exploring the blind spot, how youth who are part of and outside of the juvenile justice system are getting help for substance abuse. One option is residential treatment, such as what's offered through the ARCH program in Eagle River. ARCH stands for Adolescent Residential Center for Help. KSKA's Ann Hillman toured the facility with one of the residents.
Summer walks through the crisp, white, high-ceilinged halls of the ARCH Substance Abuse Treatment Facility. Summer is a minor, so we aren't using her real name. She passes artwork painted by some of the residents of the center and stops at a massive whiteboard of rules and notes.
This is our reflections board.
What's that mean?
Basically, with reflections, if you're on reflections with someone, you can't actually talk to them. You kind of pretend that they don't exist.
She says the idea is to stop having unhealthy conversations or codependent relationships. Sometimes the whole house of 24 youth is on reflections, and they can only talk to each other during allotted times, like group therapy. Summer hasn't been allowed to talk to one of her friends for months.
Do you miss talking to him?
Yes. He's a good friend.
What's it like to be in the same room with him but not
talk to him? It's good, though, because you can still see, like, how they're doing and how, like, how they're improving, and like you kind of still support them by doing well, and like you support them by like moving forward.
Summer is completing her 6 months of treatment for substance abuse. She started using drugs when she was 14. Her older boyfriend gave them to her. She says no one in her family noticed because she was still involved in activities at school and had a job. Then she started abusing prescription drugs, then alcohol, and eventually pot. Her relationships with guys were unhealthy. By 17, she was acting out and her parents kicked her out of the house. Last summer, she chose to go to ARCH because she knew her friend would be there.
It was nothing like I expected. Like, I expected it to be a lot more, like, loose-fitted, bunch of kids just, like, slumming it out, you know, like, not really doing anything.
What she found was an extremely structured and restricted environment. Program Director Julia Jackson says the reasons for that.
Not only does it help them feel safe and we create a system of order rather than chaos here, but we also indirectly reinforce that there is a sense of ownership, self-responsibility, and obligation to interact in socially appropriate ways, and that there is a type of law and order here, just like there is in society.
Jackson says the rules are meant to keep the teenagers focused on their treatment so they can't read books or listen to music without special permission.
We have lost many a child to The Hobbit. Just because, you know, adolescents, just like adults, but even more so, adolescents want to escape.
Jackson says the program works because it teaches the clients to respect and understand themselves and how drugs impact them. It gives them skills to resist using substances and a safety net of counselors they can always call. She says that, yes, most of the people leave the program and relapse at least once.
But I can say that the number is very high and getting higher of individuals who leave, have minor difficulties and struggles, and get back on track and stay on track. That we see that very frequently.
However, the organization doesn't have data on this. Jackson says it's up to former residents to self-report how they're doing, so they can't track a complete picture. It's just anecdotal. Unlike Summer, most of the clients at ARCH are referred by the Department of Juvenile Justice. Jackson says it provides them with strong motivation to participate.
It's sometimes a lot easier to rely on legal consequences and to rely on external factors, especially when you're dealing with the adolescent brain, where it's about instant gratification. It's about short-term sight in front of you and not seeing the big picture or the long goal.
Summer and I walk into the girls' wing. Her room has a small bulletin board covered with pictures, but otherwise it's pretty bland. They can only have more decorations or other personal items if they have special permission, called an intervention. From an outsider perspective, it seems austere, but Summer doesn't see it that way.
Like, when I go on my passes, like, I'm kind of currently, like, moving in with my grandparents, so, like, I'm, like, transitioning homes, but, like, when I came back from my home pass, I came back and I was like, oh, I'm home, my bed, but it's really, like, I don't know, it's like a house, like, full of, like, family here.
Summer is getting ready to leave the program. She says she's nervous, but she likes the idea of being back in the real world. And she has plans for the future. Stay away from most of her old friends, finish high school, learn a trade, then travel. She also wants to focus on healthy relationships.
It took me 3 months to realize that, like, I was important and that, like, the way that they treated me and the way that, like, they introduced me or how they let me hurt myself.
wasn't, like, I didn't deserve it.
And she says that's a lesson she'll take with her for life. In Eagle River, I'm Ann Hillman.
Raven Landing Senior Housing Facility in Fairbanks will begin work soon on an expansion project. The retirement community of Fairbanks has secured a loan to help finance a $7.4 million 35-unit addition to the facility off Airport Way. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the expansion is aimed at meeting a growing need for senior housing in the interior.
It's lunchtime at Raven Landing, and the residents have packed the dining area in the facility's airy, sunlit community center to enjoy the food and the company.
Nutrition and socialization are the two biggest factors.
That's Raven Landing General Manager Sue Motter.
Once the nutrition is in them, they're able to do more. And they need to interact with people.
Motter says Raven Landing enables residents to avoid the hassle and expense of maintaining a household and to instead enjoy such senior-friendly amenities as on-call attendance, a beauty salon, even Wi-Fi. And all that contributes to residents' quality of life, says Karen Parr. She's president of the Retirement Community of Fairbanks, the nonprofit that developed Raven Landing.
Many people get healthier when they get here. In fact, most people do. They've got something to do, people to talk to. A positive environment.
Parr has spearheaded development of the 60-unit facility and was among the first to move in when it opened in 2010. She says it's the only senior housing facility of its kind in Fairbanks, one of only a handful in the state, which is why its apartments are always occupied and its waiting list now has 156 names.
They're always full. They've been full from the beginning. They're always full. Long waiting list.
Demographics are driving that demand. The State Department of Labor and Workforce Development says Alaska has more baby boomers per capita than any other state, and it says Alaskans age 65 and up will be the state's fastest growing population segment over the next 25 years. Parr, who's lived in Fairbanks since 1961, says demand for housing like Raven Landing also is driven by a desire by many seniors to stick around.
A lot of us, my friends and I, didn't want to leave Fairbanks at all. This is where our lifelong friends are. This is where our families settled.
Parr says that's why the facility is named after the iconic bird that stays here and doesn't migrate.
This is a landing for ravens, the survivors. This is where we land.
Parr says the retirement community of Fairbanks wants to expand Raven Landing to help meet that demand. She says it's an independent living facility, not an assisted living facility, which offers a higher level of care. It's for seniors who can care for themselves and who have a lot of life to live.
This is a place you come because you want to enjoy the last 10 or 20 years of your life and have it productive and fun. And free of as many responsibilities as possible.
Single-bedroom apartment rents begin around $1,000 a month. Parr says the 35-unit expansion project will include a few studios that'll cost less. She says the lender notified her Friday afternoon that it had approved financing for the project. She says work will begin right away and that the project will be completed in time for the first tenants to move in around January. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Alaska Pacific University emphasizes teaching and research that engages the region's social, cultural, environmental, and geopolitical issues. The university's Early Honors program attracts academically advanced high school students who complete their senior year credits while also earning college credits as full-time APU students. This message sponsored by APU.
The Alaska Food Policy Council is wrapping up more than a year of food system research across the state. As part of the survey, the council held a series of town hall meetings from Nome to Juneau to find out how these diverse communities felt about food in their areas. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver stopped by the town hall meeting recently in Homer and has more.
Since January 2014, representatives of the Alaska Food Policy Council have been crisscrossing the state, getting a taste of local foods, food issues, and food successes. The first meeting was held in 2014 in Nome, followed by Juneau, Fairbanks, Bethel, Palmer, then Homer and Anchorage this year. The events have attracted Alaskans from all walks of life.
Well, I mean, food affects everyone every day, and so I think definitely from the farmer who, you know, was working in his fields that day or her fields that day, to the mom who wants to be able to feed her kids healthy food.
That's Chelsea Ward-Waller, a project manager with Denali Daniels and Associates, contracted with the council to lead the town hall meetings and process the feedback. She says there are a few issues of concern to the entire state because of how remote it is, like general food security in case of emergency. But the regional differences have been significant, too.
For example, Nome has some interesting issues with their reindeer herders that they're trying to get some legislation and regulations changed so that they can have some better, easier processing within the state and within the local community. And then Bethel, of course, really has a champion, Tim Meyer, there, but the rest of the community really struggles. And so that's an interesting dichotomy. And then Fairbanks is really proud, like Homer, of all of the local farmers.
Kyra Wagner is one of those proud people, but she says there's still lots to be done. She works with the Homer Farmers Market and the Sustainable Homer Initiative. She came out to share her interest in seeing locally grown food in school lunches, as well as affordable or homegrown food for low-income families.
The more people we can have growing food is going to make us more secure as a community, as far as food security, but it also in people's pocketbooks, it's much more affordable and much healthier. So it's the best of both worlds.
The Kenai Peninsula, like the Mat-Su region, is known for its fertile land and strong independent agriculture businesses. But some of its communities, like Homer, are also heavily dependent on the maritime industry. And that's where this meeting took a bit of a turn from some of the others. Emma and Claire Lakaitis, also known as the Salmon Sisters, are lifelong fishermen who also own their own fishing-themed clothing line. They're vocal advocates for sustainable and traceable seafood sourcing, and they've come to the meeting to make sure fishing is part of this conversation.
I mean, you're supporting your local economy. I don't understand why you would transport subsidized product all the way from the Midwest when you have a bay full of fish that you could start like a fish to school or farm to school program that you travel 2 miles from the base of the spit to Homer High.
Partnerships between agribusiness and the seafood industry in Alaska are just logical, says Kelly Harrell. She works for the Alaska Marine Conservation Council, which is co-hosting this meeting.
We're talking about protecting food security. You know, it's salmon with a lot of Alaskans. That's one of our major food sources there. So definitely recognize the need for more fisheries and seafood-minded folks to be engaged with the Food Policy Council and make sure that the discussion wasn't just about agriculture, it was about seafood and how to get more local seafood into our schools and into the hands of consumers.
She's also a governing board member for the Food Council and says the next step is collating all of the research and feedback from the communities. Then she says the council will likely reach out to its various member organizations to prioritize possible projects or focus areas.
We have a common interest in working to overcome and building a better food system. So I think the sky's the limit and a lot of collaboration to be had in the future.
And the ultimate goal is two-sided, to ensure all Alaskans have access to affordable, healthy, sustainable food, and to engage those same Alaskans so they can help make the decisions that could affect their food system far into the future. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
The 45th annual Native Youth Olympics wrapped up in Anchorage this weekend. More than 500 athletes from the furthest corners of the state were joined for the first time in decades by a foreign delegation, a team from the Yukon Territory in Canada. As KSKA's Zechariah Hughes reports, NYO continues growing in popularity across Alaska.
The Seal Hop is one of 10 events jammed into 3 days of competition, held for the first time ever on the arena floor of the Alaska Airlines Center. And while it's thrilling, it can be kind of hard to watch high schoolers in push-up pose bounce on knuckles and fists for dozens of feet before collapsing. It's supposed to hurt.
Seal Hop is an endurance game. It also is a game that tests your ability to handle pain.
Marjorie Tabone is an NYO coach from Nome and a former competitor herself. The games are adaptations of traditional practices and competitions rooted in subsistence.
So if you can imagine a long time ago, the young hunters would have to go out and they would have to stalk the seal, and they would have to get as close as possible to the seal in order to harpoon it. And so the seal hop was invented just for that purpose.
The games were a way for hunters to keep their bodies in shape during the cold, dark winter months. Some, like the Indian stick pole, were good practice for the strong wrists you need handling salmon on a fish wheel. Others have evolved to carry different lessons. The one-foot high kick was originally a way to signal a successful hunt from across the sea ice. As Tabon watches, she says nowadays, the game's real lesson is focus.
Which was and still is so important for surviving out in the Arctic when you're hunting and when you're waiting for that seal patiently and trying to stay focused, because if you don't pay attention, you're going to miss it. You're going to lose your chance to feed your family. You're going to miss it. And that directly applies to our life now. I mean, if we aren't paying attention, if we're goofing off and we're not trying to stay focused, then we're going to miss it. Whatever it is, we're going to miss it.
Tabon and many of her fellow coaches believe the games are a way of protecting and reinforcing the value system that was built into the subsistence cultures spread across Alaska. Nick Hansen has been coaching in Unalakleet for 6 years and says that even though the hunting methods have changed, the values are durable.
The games still definitely connect us to the way we hunt today. I mean, we now hunt with boats and guns instead of ice hopping on the ice, but we still want the other hunter with us in the boat to be just as strong as we are. We still want to share what we catch with our community, and that's what the games are all about.
Hansen is kind of an NYO superstar. He holds records, received an award this year for embodying traditional values, and even did a backflip during the blanket toss. He is also appearing next month on the TV show American Ninja Warrior. But the athletics for him are just a fringe benefit of the cultural connections that are part of the games. One of his athletes, Mikian Ivanov, got first place in the one-foot high kick. He says NYO is different from the other sports he plays because, fundamentally, it's not about competition.
I mean, yeah, we're competing against each other, but everybody is trying to max out, and everybody wants each other to max out and do their best.
At the end of the tournament, Ivanov was awarded the Sportsmanship Award. Nicole Johnston organizes the NYO tournaments and held the record for women's two-foot high kick for 25 years. Since her days competing, the size of the games has tripled, and she thinks that's in part because Alaskans are working more deliberately to protect native values.
People are a lot more concerned about preserving the culture now with Western influences or influences from the lower 48. They want to make sure that everybody is holding on to what they've learned from their elders. So the games have actually grown because of that.
Even the podium stresses the value of mutual strength. The top spot is too high to climb up alone without help from someone you beat on your way to the top. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, you can find them online at alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, and Shady Grove Oliver in Homer. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. The University of Alaska Southeast School of Management offers online college degrees for the unconventional student or working professional who wants learning on their schedule and timeline. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.